Hare Krishna. Today we are beginning a new chapter in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 14, King Pururava enchanted by Urvashi. The summary of this 14th chapter is given as follows. This chapter describes Soma and how he kidnapped the wife of Brihaspati and begot in her womb a son named Buddha. Buddha begot Pururava, who begot six sons, headed by Ayu, in the womb of Urvashi. Lord Brahma was born from the lotus that sprouted from the navel of Garbhodakshayi Vishnu. Brahma had a son named Atri, and Atri's son was Soma, the king of all drugs and stars. Soma became the conqueror of the entire universe. And being inflated with pride, he kidnapped Tara, who was the wife of Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods. A great fight ensued between the demigods and the asuras, but Brahma rescued Brihaspati's wife from the clutches of Soma and returned her to her husband, thus stopping the fighting. In the womb of Tara, Soma begot a son named Buddha, who later begot in the womb of Ila a son named Ila, or Pururava. Urvasi was captivated by Pururava's beauty, and therefore she lived with him for some time. But when she left his company, he became almost like a madman. While traveling all over the world, he met Urvasi again at Kurukshetra. But she agreed to join with him for only one night in a year. 1 year later, Pururava saw Urvashi at Kurukshetra and was glad to be with her for one night. But when he thought of her leaving him again, he was overwhelmed with grief. Urvashi then advised Pururava to worship the Kandarvas. Being satisfied with Pururava, the Kandarvas gave him a woman known as Agnistali. Pururava mistook Agnistali for Urvashi. But while he was wandering in the forest, his misunderstanding was cleared, and he immediately gave up her company. After returning home and meditating upon Urvashi all night, he wanted to perform a Vedic ritualistic ceremony to satisfy his desire. Therefore, he went to the same place where he had left Agnistali. And there he saw that from the womb of a shami tree had come an asvata tree. Pururava made two sticks from this tree and thus produced a fire. By such a fire, one can satisfy all lusty desires. The fire was considered the son of Pururava. In Satya Yuga, there was only one social division called Hamsa. There were no divisions of Varna, like Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. The Veda was the Omkar. The various demigods were not worshipped, for only the Supreme Personality of Godhead was the worshipable deity. So now we will read and recite text 1. Translation. Srila Shukadev Goswami said to Maharaj Parikshit, O King, thus far you have heard the description of the dynasty of the sun god. Now hear the most glorious and purifying description of the dynasty of the moon god. This description mentions kings like Ayla, Pururava, of whom it is glorious to hear. There's no purport, so we'll continue to the next verse. Sahasra shirasa pumso nabi radha saro ruhat jatasya sit suto datur atri pitri samo gunai. Lord Vishnu, Garbhodakshai Vishnu, is known as Sahasra Shirsha Purusha. From the lake of his navel sprang a lotus on which Lord Brahma was generated. Atri, the son of Lord Brahma, was as qualified as his father. Again, there is no purport, so we'll proceed to the next verse. Tasya drigbyo bhavat putra somo mritamaya kila viproshadyu dugananam brahmana kapita pati. From Atri's tears of jubilation was born a son named Soma, the moon, who was full of soothing rays. Lord Brahma appointed him the director of brahmanas, drugs, and luminaries. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. According to the Vedic description, Soma, the moon god, was born from the mind of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Chandrama Manaso Jataha. But here we find that Soma was born from the tears in the eyes of Atri. This appears contradictory to the Vedic information, but actually it is not. For this birth of the moon is understood to have taken place in another millennium. When tears appear in the eyes because of jubilation, the tears are soothing. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Jrigbhya Anandashrubhya Ata Evam Ritam Maya. Here the word Jrigbhya means from tears of jubilation. Therefore, the moon god is called Amritamaya, full of soothing rays. In the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 4.1.15, we find this verse. Atre patnyanusuya trin yagye suya sasasutan datam durvasanam somam atmesha brahma sambhavan. This verse describes that Anasuya, the wife of Atri Rishi, bore three sons, Soma, Durvasa, and Dattatreya. It is said that at the time of conception, Anasuya was impregnated by the tears of Atri. Translation again. From Atri's tears of jubilation was born a son named Soma, the moon, who was full of soothing rays. Lord Brahma appointed him the director of the Brahmins, drugs, and luminaries. Hare Krishna. To an ordinary person, the descriptions here in Srimad Bhagavatam may sound fantastic in the sense of fantasy. But we must consider how limited we are before we pass judgment. Srila Prabhupada often gave the example of the frog in the well, whom he sometimes called Dr. Frog, PhD. So Dr. Frog, PhD, lived in a well. And somehow one of his other colleagues saw the Atlantic Ocean. And he came back and he reported that I have seen a very huge body of water. And Dr. Frog replied, how big? Is it twice as big as my well? Oh no, it's much, much bigger. Well, is it three times or four times? And frogs, they can take in air and puff themselves up. So Dr. Frog, PhD, he was like taking in air to, like, how big is it? You know, like challenging, how big is it? As big as this, as big as this. And he exploded. That was the end of Dr. Frog, PhD. So we are like frogs in a well, especially in Kali Yuga. Our potencies are much diminished. And so when we hear such fantastic stories, we may find them hard to believe because they don't fit within our limited experience. But we should approach the scriptures in a humble mood. Actually, we should approach everything in a humble mood, because for one who is proud, everything becomes difficult. And sometimes even devotees can become proud. We just read how Soma became proud, and out of pride he kidnapped Tara, who is the wife of the spiritual master of the demigods. Hare Krishna. That's pretty bad. But that's what pride can do. And it is said even in English literature, pride cometh before a fall. When someone becomes proud, he's almost asking for a fall down. In the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we read about King Indra, who had become proud, and out of his pride, Hare Krishna, Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki jai, Shri Shri Gaur Nithai ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So out of his pride, he attempted to destroy the whole village of Vrindavan, including all of Krishna's dearest devotees. And although Krishna accomplished many things in the Govardhan Leela, one important thing he accomplished was smashing the pride of Indra. Because when one is maddened by pride, one can do anything. But one will have to suffer the consequences. And Krishna never likes his devotees to become proud. And if any devotee does become proud, he takes action. There is a story that a king, a little sort of temperamental king, he asked his minister, what is God's constant activity? And it couldn't be creation, because that's temporary. And it couldn't be destruction, because that's also temporary. And it couldn't be maintenance, because sometimes there's creation and sometimes there's destruction. So his minister didn't know what to answer, and he didn't want to face the king's wrath. So he told the king, actually, you have not asked the right person. You should ask the court priest, the court pundit. So the king asked the court pundit, and he was also stuck. But he also didn't want to face the king's wrath. So he said, give me 1 week, and I will go through the scriptures, and I will reply. But the pundit felt very uncomfortable, like he wasn't going to come up with the answer. So he also didn't want to face the king's wrath. So he decided to leave town. And as he was leaving town, he met one of his disciples, who was a very simple laborer. And his disciple asked him, Guru Maharaj, where are you going? He said, well, the king has asked me a very difficult question, and you know he's very temperamental, and so I'm leaving. So the disciple said, well, what was the question? He said, oh, I'm the guru. If I don't know the answer, how are you going to know the answer? He said, no, just tell me what is the question. So he told him the question. He said, okay, at the appointed time, I will go on your behalf. So at the appointed time, he went. And, you know, he came into the court. The king was sitting on his throne. And he said, I've come on behalf of my spiritual master to answer your question. But there is a discrepancy here. You're sitting on the throne. You're sitting on a higher level than me. And that is not proper according to etiquette. You are inquiring. You're taking the position of the student. And I'm answering. So I should sit on a higher level than you. I will sit on the throne. And you sit down here. So the king didn't like that, but he was intelligent. He knew that according to etiquette, what the simple young man had said was correct. So as that the simple disciple was walking towards the throne and the king was getting down, he said to the simple disciple, this better be good. Otherwise, you're going to face the consequences of my wrath. So the simple disciple got up on the throne and he said, God's constant activity is that he is always exalting the humble and humbling the exalted, means the pride, the proud. If you're proud, God will humble you, and if you're humble, God will exalt you. And this is God's constant work, and you're seeing it right at this very moment in your own life. You were proud, and now you are down there. And so that is God's constant work. And whenever he sees a devotee who is proud, he will make an arrangement to smash that pride And a very vivid example is King Indra, who was so maddened by pride that he was ready to kill the cows, the cowherd community, Krishna's parents, everyone, all of Krishna's dearmost devotees. And Krishna could have just killed him, or he could have summoned him. Now, what do you think you're doing? Do you know who I am? I'm your master. But he didn't. What Krishna did was he protected the Brijbasis, and there was a tremendous festival of love under Govardhan Hill. It was unprecedented. It was a continuous festival of love for a week. In fact, it was such an ecstatic festival that after a week, when Indra realized to some extent his mistake, and he called back all the Samvartaka clouds and everything, the Brijbasis didn't want to leave. They wanted to continue to stay under Govardhan Hill with their festival. But as far as Indra goes, Krishna ignored him. And this is often the best medicine for a proud person who wants, you know, name and fame and worship, is just to ignore them. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we do this with devotees, but Krishna totally ignored him. And that made Indra even more nervous, because he didn't know what was going on. Anyway, it's a long story, and it's a beautiful story. But in the end, Indra realized that he was in very big trouble. He realized that he was in his position as Indra, the king of heaven, by the mercy of Krishna. It's not that he was elected by an assembly of demigods. He was appointed by Krishna. And he went against Krishna and Krishna's dear ones in the most horrible way. So he realized he was in big trouble. Anyway, it's a long story and an interesting story, but he asked for help. Like, what do I do? And Lord Brahma suggested, don't go alone. Because when Krishna sees you, he may be very angry. But you should go with Surabhi. Surabhi is like a heavenly cow, because you were so offensive to the cows, so you should go with Surabhi. And when Krishna sees Surabhi, he'll become happy. And then eventually you can present yourself to him. And Indra followed the advice. But the final result was that Indra became humble. That was the point. And Krishna told him that I do not like any of my devotees to become proud. So someone might wonder why in Srimad Bhagavatam there are so many stories about kings. In fact, there is a definition of Purana? What qualifies a literature as being a Purana? And one of the elements is that it must contain a genealogy of kings. So why? Why should a spiritual literature have to contain a genealogy of kings? And the answer is that kings are like the highest emblem of what a conditioned soul wants to be. I mean, actually, underneath it all, we want to be God. But in the material world, if we can't be God, then at least we could be a king. And kings had so much power. They had power over life and death. I mean, they could order someone to be killed, and that was the end. But kings are also unhappy. Everyone in the material world is unhappy. And therefore, the Puranas have stories of kings just to illustrate the fact that no one can be happy in the material world without Krishna consciousness, even if you're a king. And we see from many of these descriptions in this chapter how these very powerful people got into trouble because they were under the control of lust and other inebrieties. So, okay, you can't be happy even by becoming a king or the king of the demigods or anyone. But you want to be happy. Everyone wants to be happy. So how do you become happy? And actually, there is, you know, every generation is different. It arises in a different context and it faces different challenges. So, of course, even in this room, there are different generations. But say, if we take my generation's parents or grandparents, many of them were immigrants. They came to America, and they had to struggle to establish themselves, earn a living, and support their families. Then our generation, we were sort of born to parents who'd already dealt with that challenge of basic maintenance. And so we sort of had the luxury of not having to worry about all those things. Or to put it in plain language, we had the luxury of not having to work. And so from our generation, you got like hippies and so on. And then, because we were sort of like rebelling against our parents and grandparents, as Srila Prabhupada said about the hippies, that they know what's wrong. They're rejecting the stereotype materialistic way of life, but they don't know what's right. And then the next generation, and, you know, by then I was already in the movement and spending most of my time in India. But they, you know, they didn't want to be hippies. or, you know, counter-cultural. They wanted to be rich. They wanted to be successful. In fact, there was a survey done at the University of California why students enrolled. And the vast majority said they enrolled because they wanted to be able to learn things that would help them be affluent and successful, which is a very different situation than our generation. You know, when I went to the university, I wanted to find out the meaning of life, you know. So that next generation, they did everything that they were told would make them happy. And a lot of them, you know, they did it quite well. It means they got like a qualified spouse, either a good job or a lucrative business, and, you know, like beautiful children. They went on fabulous holidays. You know, they did everything that they were told would make them happy. But guess what? They weren't happy. So this phenomenon gave rise to a whole new study of psychology, or anyway, what makes people happy? Because there's like a generation of people who did everything that was supposed to make them happy, and they didn't become happy. So then, now what do we do? So, I mean, I also won't discuss too much about it, but there, one of the main researchers in the field, he was a professor at Harvard University. He was actually mentioned in a BTG article by Ravindrasroop Prabhu, so it's bona fide to mention him. And he wrote a book called Stumbling on Happiness, and which came to me by chance. And his basic premise is that we human beings are very poor at predicting what will make us happy. And you more or less just stumble on it. I mean, if you're lucky, you just stumble on it. Otherwise, most people just are not happy. And there have been many other studies that suggest that, you know, people have a sort of baseline of happiness. And all the things that they think will increase their happiness, like what we listed, will hardly affect their baseline of happiness, maybe 5%. It hardly makes any difference. And things that do actually affect their happiness are things like meditation, doing something meaningful that helps others, you know, things that people don't ordinarily consider, things that are not, you know, in the range of acquiring material things. And a lot of the findings corroborate the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam. I mean, we don't actually really need to read any of these things, but sometimes when we speak to people, it's good to, it may be good to cite that kind of evidence for people who don't have faith. But that's the basic teaching of Srimad Bhagavatam, that our happiness, yes, the Bhagavatam says, Narada says it in the first canto and Prahlad says it in the seventh canto, that our, that nobody wants misery. Does anyone here want misery? Raise your hand if you want misery. Does anyone come in to the temple and pray for misery? No. We all want happiness. But misery comes. So Srimad Bhagavatam says that just as misery comes without our asking for it, similarly, happiness will also come without our asking for it. We don't make any effort to get misery, but it comes. So in the same way, without making any effort, whatever happiness is due to us will come. So we should not waste our time trying to increase our happiness or decrease our misery, because they will come as destined by our karma. But rather we should use our time and energy to become Krishna conscious. And if we really take this one instruction to heart, you know, we will transform our lives. Because although we are devotees and we do know the philosophy, but we still have that conditioning to try to increase our happiness and try to decrease our distress. And so much mental energy goes into that. And then depending, the physical exertion also goes into it. But if we could just, I mean, yes, we do, you know, sort of take normal precautions, like if we're sick or, you know, or to avoid sickness. But basically, we just accept whatever is destined to us, knowing that it's going to come anyway. And really invest our time and energy in becoming Krishna conscious, which will really make us happy. The nectar of devotion, Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, lists six characteristics of pure devotional service. One is kleshagani, relief from distress. And the other is Shubhada, it bestows auspiciousness. And these two characteristics come at the stage of sadhana bhakti. There are other ones that come at the stage of bhava bhakti, two more at bhava bhakti, and the last two at prema bhakti. But these two come at sadhana bhakti, kleshagni, relief from material distress, and Shubhada, bestows auspiciousness. And what is auspiciousness? There are different elements to auspiciousness, but one of the elements is happiness. It's not the same happiness that comes, you know, at bhava bhakti or prema, but there is happiness right from the beginning of sadhana bhakti. And you know, we feel it. But because of conditioning and you could say mundane association, we get Because they lured by the false promise of, you know, increasing our happiness or reducing our distress by the standard material formulas, which don't work. Even scientifically, it's been proven that they don't work. Not more than a few percent. So our mission, once an interviewer asked Srila Prabhupada, what is the purpose of life? He said the purpose of life is to become happy, which anyone can relate to. But there's a process, and there are degrees of happiness. And so Srila Prabhupada's mission was to give the process for absolute happiness. When Srila Prabhupada was staying at the Sindhya Workers' Colony in Andheri, which is near Juhu, you know, preparing to go to America. So one of the officers of the Sindhya Steam Navigation Company sort of joked with him and said, "Oh, Swamiji, I know why you want to go to America. All the Swamis, they want to go to the West. They want to enjoy." And Srila Prabhupada replied, "You know, what have I got to enjoy? I'm almost 70 years old. But I know that there is a generation of young people who are very confused and frustrated, and I want to go for them to make them happy." That was, he wanted to make us happy. And being with Srila Prabhupada made us happy. And of course, we do have the perfect philosophy and the perfect process. But even without knowing that, just being with Srila Prabhupada could make you happy. Because he was someone who genuinely cared for you. And that's so rare. I mean, it's so rare. So just to find someone who genuinely cared for you and wasn't like on an ego trip or, you know, trying to get something for himself from you, but really wanted nothing but to see you happy, that itself was enough to make people happy. And then the other things followed. Once another reporter asked Srila Prabhupada that you've dedicated your whole life to Krishna. And, you know, reading these types of descriptions, you know, it could make someone wonder, you know, is this really true? So once a reporter asked Srila Prabhupada that you've dedicated your life to Krishna, you're doing everything for Krishna. But what if in the end there is no Krishna? And Srila Prabhupada replied, "I wouldn't do a single thing different. Because what am I doing? I'm chanting Krishna's name. I'm speaking Krishna's glories. I'm eating Krishna prasad. I'm associating with Krishna's devotees. And I'm getting so much happiness from everything I'm doing. Even if there was no Krishna, I would still do it. I wouldn't do anything different." So I think this is the ultimate factor Because it's true. I mean, if someone's in the mood to argue, there could be so many arguments. But if someone wants happiness, which we want, if someone wants love, which we want, in fact, you really can't have happiness without love, then this is the place. And it doesn't really depend on what other people think. Once Bhakti Tirtha Swami was like a child evangelist in the Christian religion. And so he was interviewed by, I guess, a Christian evangelist who asked him, you were a child evangelist, and now you're a Hare Krishna. I mean, what happened? And Bhakti Tirtha Swami said, very intelligently, "I'm no more a Hare Krishna than you are. You know, I was looking for love of God. If I could have found love of God in the Boy Scouts, I would have joined the Boy Scouts. But I happened to find it here. And that's why I'm here. And if you can show me a place where I can get it in a better way, then I'll go there." So it's not a question of like sectarian designation. It's just a question of where you find what you want. And that's basically love, pure love, and happiness, which then the two go together. So, and I don't know why each one of you is here, but even if you just stumbled on it, well, you stumbled into the right place, and there's no need to go anywhere else. And just one thing about the youth. One of my dear friends, His Holiness Ratatva Goswami, has done a lot for the youth in America in particular. But he's been everywhere. He's brought a group to Europe and spent time in Mayapur. But he said that about the children of devotees, that they are born into the Hare Krishna movement, but they haven't joined the Hare Krishna movement. They still have to decide to join. And so we who have knowingly or unknowingly stumbled into this ocean of nectar should act in such a way that they want to join. Because there's a difference, big difference. That will be a great contribution to the movement and to those fortunate souls who've been born into the Hare Krishna movement and who are still waiting to decide whether to join or not. Hare Krishna. So are there any questions or comments?